Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and we are joined this first segment by the Center for Security Policy's Fred Flights, who is our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs, and the person we turn to when we want to know what is actually going on, among other things, with Iran and the Iran deal. Fred, your new book, Obama Bomb, is coming out, the second edition, fresh with all of the new pallets and plane loads of cash and the rest of the outrages. But I wanted to, talk first about what was said at the vice presidential debate when Tim Kaine made the claim that Hillary had helped stop, and I use the word eliminate, the Iranian nuclear program. I have a hard time believing that. Maybe it's just me, the skeptic, but I don't think they either stopped the nuclear program or that Hillary was all that vital in doing it. Did they manage to accomplish that?
No, Jim. It really was stunning to hear Kaine say that the nuclear agreement stopped Iran's nuclear program and that Israel supports the nuclear agreement. The nuclear agreement at best postpones Iran's nuclear program, and that's what Mike Pence said. But in fact, Iran keeps its entire nuclear infrastructure and continues to enrich uranium and develop advanced centrifuges while the deal is in effect, which means it is increasing its capability to make more nuclear weapons even faster every day that this agreement is in effect.
But why would they be bragging about this? Last time I checked about the Iran deal, it polled somewhere in the 20s or 30s for support. I mean, Hillary's got a professional campaign and Kaine's her guy. Do they actually think that this is an issue that is a winner for them? Do they think they've deluded the American public that far?
Well, it's a vulnerability. They see how Iran's behavior has gotten so much worse since the agreement was announced in July 2015, with Iran testing missiles, harassing U.S. shipment in the Gulf, and there's been reports of cheating on the deal. So they're basically trying to create this big lie, or at least muddy the water, so the American people don't know what to believe. I got to tell you, this idea that Israel supports the deal, you know, we can argue whether the deal works or not. I think the evidence is clear that it doesn't. But the evidence is absolutely clear that Israel opposes the deal. That's why Netanyahu came to the United Nations in September and condemned the deal again. We can't argue that Israel's for the deal when the head of the Israeli government comes to the United States and says he opposes the deal. They cherry-picked a few officials in Israel who liked the deal. Well, we could do that in the United States, too. It was a bald-faced lie, and I think it was embarrassing for them.
Fred, there's some more things that have been coming out about just how bad the deal is. Now, you mentioned Iran's bad behavior and some of the cheating, but there's also been some more information about more secret side deals that the Obama administration made as far as lifting sanctions from Iranian banks. What were they doing there?
Well, there's two banks, Bank SEPA and Bank SEPA International, that had been financing Iran's ballistic missile program. And under the agreement, U.N. sanctions on these banks were not to be lifted for 8 years. The administration also promised Congress, when it briefed the deal to Congress in the summer of 2015, that non-nuclear sanctions would stay in place. This is important because these missile programs have one purpose, to build delivery systems for nuclear weapons. Well, on the day that the U.S. prisoners, who I would call hostages, were released on January 17th, the Security Council voted to lift sanctions on these banks. No one knew at the time, but the Wall Street Journal just revealed there was a secret deal linking the plane loads of cash, the release of the U.S. hostages, and lifting sanctions against these Iranian banks, all part of a secret ransom deal.
Fred, I wish I could maintain the level of outrage that the disgraceful behavior of the Obama administration warrants for these things. I mean, not only did they pay ransom, They lied about it. They obfuscated it. They added many other pieces that were just, honestly, it's horrifying that they paid ransom for U.S. Prisoners. But it's even worse that in doing this deal, they tied that to all these other things that facilitate more dangerous things for the world and the region. I mean, have they basically decided that anything was worth it to get this deal done and that somehow this was going to really turn Iran's behavior around?
I think they were desperate for this agreement for the president's legacy. I might also add that an Obama official has admitted these three things were related. That's not just me saying this. An Obama official told this to the Wall Street Journal, and I detail this in my new National Review article. I think there was something within the president thinking that this agreement would somehow improve Iran's behavior. I think it is a symptomatic of his extreme incompetence and naive worldview. There are people in Washington on the left who think we can live with a nuclear Iran. I think Obama is one of them. And we've just found out that it hasn't improved Iran's behavior. Actually, it has emboldened Iran to become a much more dangerous enemy.
Fred, if Iran is, as you said, at best, still on a path to nuclear weapons and building the delivery systems for them, and now in possession of planes and pallets and probably shiploads of cash as a result of this, what are they doing with it? I mean, has this led to the expected increase in terror funding and belligerent activity by them all through the region?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why did Iran want this $1.7 billion, $400 million for U.S. debt plus $1.3 billion in interest? Why do they want it in cash? They wanted an untraceable source of funds, and I think it's probably been spent on terrorism, and I think it probably has been, some of it has probably been sent to North Korea, because I believe Iran has begun to outsource its nuclear weapons research efforts in North Korea.
Oh, that's pleasant, because the North Koreans weren't enough trouble anyhow. Now they have a client for their nuclear weapons program who's got cash that we gave them to allow the Iranians to become a bigger problem for everyone. So now I guess the interesting question is, if the Iranians are working with the North Koreans, who are the Saudis working with to buy their bomb? Because I cannot see a world where the Saudis and the other Gulf Arab states allow their biggest or second biggest enemy after us, the Iranians, to be a nuclear power and them not to be.
Well, there have been reports that Saudi Arabia will or has purchased nuclear weapons from Pakistan because of the threat it sees from the Iranian nuclear program.
So there we go. Now, in addition to facilitating the growth and hegemony of the largest state sponsor of terror, the Iranians, the deranged mullahs, President Obama has put in place and put in progress a path to a nuclear-armed Gulf where a bunch of countries who have apocalyptic mindsets will now have apocalyptic tools. Is there any way now that we can really slow this down if the Saudis have either started to or already on that path, or are we going to have to figure out how to live with this?
Well, the key is we have to tear up this nuclear agreement or dramatically revise it to stop all transfers of nuclear technology to Iran and put stiff sanctions on Iran until it stops its nuclear weapons work, stops its sponsorship of terrorism and its belligerent activity in the Middle East. And as long as we tolerate this, it's going to get worse, and it's going to lead to a missile and nuclear proliferation in the region.
The last place in the world, I mean, not that North Korea is not a nightmare scenario having nuclear weapons already, but given the proclivities of the Saudis and the rest to push this thing, I can't imagine how that's good. Is there then a solution other than regime change in Iran? Do we need to go back to that, which was actually the right answer?
Ultimately, we need regime change, but I think it's going to be a while till that's possible because the regime has an iron grip on the country. But in the meantime, we have to stop it from getting the military technology and finances, which we know it's using to increase its military. Iran's military budget will have a 90% increase in 2016, and most of that is being funded, I believe, from the $150 billion and sanctuary it got from the nuclear deal. I mean, think about that.
Fred, every time I think about that, I have trouble sleeping at night. So I'm going to continue doing that, and I hope all the listeners will as well, because this is not something we can ignore. Fred Flight, Senior Vice President at the Center for Security Policy, thank you so much. Up next, we will be continuing the discussion of the foreign policy debacles during the Obama administration with my rant.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. This is Jim Hansen, and we're going to continue the discussion of why the Iran nuclear deal is not just a debacle, but part of a larger problem with the Obama policy aided and abetted by his secretaries of state, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, of their entire attitude toward Iran. Now, let's be clear. Iran is our enemy. Iran is the enemy of all mankind. The mullahs are crazy. They've been running that country since 1979, killing Americans, killing people all over the world as the largest state sponsor of terror. And yet, from the day he came to office, President Obama and his administration refused to look at their history, or even worse, the actions they were taking while he was in office that showed not only are they not a partner for peace, but they are the largest problem to creating peace in the entire region. But Barack Obama was bound and determined at any cost to get himself a legacy as a nuclear arms cutter by forging a deal with those mullahs. Consequently, whatever they did, whatever provocations they had, it did not matter because he said, they're my guys. They're the ones who are going to give me what I most need. And if Barack Obama is bound and determined to do one thing, it's to make Barack Obama look good. So once he had decided that was the goal, the mullahs could do nothing to dissuade him from that path. And during the conduct of the Iran deal, we saw this. The secret side deals to refuse to allow inspectors to go anyplace unless the Iranians pre-cleared it, to require the inspectors to only go to sites the Iranians approved. And even worse, the pallets of cash going to them as ransom for our hostages. This was evidence that Barack Obama's policies towards the Iranians were horrendous. Now, we were discussing the fact that they determined that at any cost, they would do a nuclear arms deal with Iran because President Obama decided that was going to be his legacy to the world. Obviously, any sentient being can see that that was not just a dismal failure, but that is going to come back and haunt us all. But let's talk about the other failures. Let's talk about the other pieces of the puzzle that this fixation of the Obama administration led them to ignore. Before he even came to power, the Iranian regime was supporting the Shia rebels, the Shia extremist terrorists in Iraq who were killing U.S. soldiers. They were providing explosively formed projectiles, the most devastating form of IEDs that could penetrate our armored vehicles, and killed hundreds of U.S. troops and wounded many more. We knew they were doing that. They knew they were doing that. That didn't matter. They knew that they were testing missiles. They knew that all these things were going on. None of it was going to sway them from their determination that they were going to go ahead and follow this path. I mean, it seemed like they were willing to turn John Kennedy's quote that we would pay any price and bear any burden in the support of liberty to say we will pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, oppose any friend, support any foe in order to assure the survival and legacy of Barack Obama. Now, one of the most heinous things they did, and this was President Obama and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, happened early on in the Obama administration. The phone rang at 3 a.m. It was the Iranian people, and they were calling to let them know that their election was being stolen, that the Iranian mullahs were taking away the faux democracy and the ability of the Iranian people to actually elect a government that represented them, and that they were going to rebel. The Green Movement, it was in the streets. It was the largest protests since 1979 when the mullahs took to the streets and overthrew the Shah. So the Iranian people knew the election was stolen. They knew that their candidates had been suppressed. They knew that all of this was counter to any pretense that there was an actual democracy. And they asked for help. Now, the United States has contingencies in place to support popular uprisings. Any place where the world has decided, or a country's people have decided, that they want to overthrow a dictator, they want to overthrow an oppressive regime, and they want actual democracy, we have contingencies in place to support that. The Iranians called, the phone was answered, and the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton told them to go pound sand. They supported the mullahs. They ignored the people in the streets being shot, being killed, being beaten, being tortured, crying out for democracy. And that was not of interest to President Obama and Secretary Clinton because they had a nuclear deal to do and they had decided the mullahs were their partners for peace in that endeavor. The Iranian people deserved better than that. The world deserved better than that. Can you imagine if in 2009, instead of supporting the most oppressive regime, the largest state sponsor of terror, President Obama and Secretary Clinton had put their weight behind the Iranian people, who are much more moderate, who just want to live their lives and who are willing to be a productive member of the Society of Nations, given a chance to run their own country. They got nothing. They got slaughtered is what they got. They got shot dead. They got shut down. And it was the policy of the Obama administration, implemented by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, that allowed that to happen. I can think of no more disgraceful moment in this administration's history than the choice between the moderate Iranian people and the crazy as loons mullahs with their 12th Imam cult and their desire to bring an Armageddon-like return of that 12th Imam. They chose the crazy Islamists who they have now helped on their path to foment terrorism, to build missiles, and without a doubt on the path to build nuclear weapons. That was their choice. That was who they backed. That was what they did. How much different would the world be right now if when they had the chance to support freedom and liberty and a democracy in the Middle East in a place where we have too few friends to start with, instead of deciding that their friends were the most oppressive regime in modern history, they had chosen to back that Green Revolution. They had chosen to stand and at least make even a statement. They said nothing, and they told the CIA, who had ties with the rebels of the Green Revolution, to sever those ties, to stop any coordination, communication, and certainly any assistance for these people to gain self-determination, to take their necks out from under the iron sandal of that deranged Iranian regime. How can they live with themselves? How can they actually say that in any way, shape, or form, they not only crushed the right of those people to have a voice in their own lives and government, but even worse, that they chose to make common cause with the Iranian mullahs, with the folks who they now have sent those pallets of cash, those plane loads of cash, those billions of dollars that are now being spent to kill more people, to kill more Americans, to kill more innocents, to foment rebellion, to crush any other freedom, to further the ability of the Iranians to become the hegemon in that region. That was the choice that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama made. And they need to live with that for the rest of their lives. It's a disgrace. That's going to wrap up this rant. We'll be back after the break with Rowan Scarborough of the Washington Times, who has a new story about the Clinton-Obama arms-dealing debacles in Libya. Shocking, I know.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Of all Barack Obama's disastrous legacies, the Middle East being bequeathed to his successor may be the most problematic. His undermining of Israel, help in toppling friendly governments, empowering of Iran, and embrace of Islamic supremacists of the Muslim Brotherhood have inflamed the region. They've also contributed to the mass migration threatening the same in Europe. As Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton was intimately involved in these decisions. Ditto, her most influential advisor, Brotherhood-tied Huma Abedin. Daily Caller's Richard Pollack reveals just-released Abedin emails showing her contemptuously discouraging ex-President Bill Clinton from addressing the pro-Israel group AIPAC. As Huma is universally expected to have a top job in a Hillary Clinton administration, we need to know, what role did she play in the disasters to date, and will her Islamist lineage lead to more and worse in the future? This is Frank Gaffney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. This is Jim Hansen, and we are going to talk now with Rowan Scarborough, national security reporter at the Washington Times and author of the bestseller Rumsfeld's War, The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander, and Sabotage, America's Enemies Within the CIA. Well, Rowan, you have a very interesting piece out today, and it opens up again, a can of worms that some folks, both in the White House and on the campaign trail, probably don't want open, but the American people really need to know about. So I want to talk about the case where Mark Turi, an American citizen who had been under some fairly serious charges for arms dealing related to Libya, has now had those charges dropped, and talk about perhaps why his knowledge of some back-channel dealings between Hillary and other folks running guns in the area as well, or trying to, may have led to that. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Turi is a licensed U.S. arms broker who has a knack for finding arms makers in Eastern Europe and having them ship their weapons to different countries with the approval of the State Department. So he attempted to help out the Libyan rebels in 2011 when Gaddafi was going down. And for his efforts, suddenly he found himself charged in 2014 with illegal arms trading because he put on the application that he was going to get the arms to Qatar and the Persian Gulf, but actually they were headed to Libya. And after the indictment, what he started to allege was another Hillary Clinton cover-up when it came to Libya, that the State Department knew about what he was doing and actually condoned it. And thus, if he was breaking the law, then Hillary Clinton and the State Department and the Obama administration were breaking the law by encouraging him to do this. And so discovery went on in U.S. District Court in Arizona, where the U.S. attorneys filed the case. And then, boom, this week, suddenly the Justice Department moved to drop all the charges. And the reason is because his very aggressive defense lawyers started putting in discovery requests for documents that they know exist inside the Obama administration that will prove his case. And boom, the case went away.
He seems to have been following whether he could prove that Hillary's State Department approved this particular attempted transaction. They were certainly supporting the rebels attempting to overthrow Gaddafi. We had plenty of pipe hitters and other covert types on the ground making things happen and assisting in that effort, as well as leading, you know, the coalition from behind to bomb him into submission. So his story has a pretty solid ring of truth that, you know, this would be another way that they could help overthrow Gaddafi.
If his story is true, it means that Hillary Clinton violated the United Nations resolution, which she pushed through so she could bomb Libya. And that resolution said that no arms from any member state are to go into Libya during a certain period. And the story Mr. Turi is telling is that they basically violated that law by encouraging him to do this. And there is some basic evidence that she was interested in getting arms into Libya in 2011, because in an email that the Benghazi committee released, there's a discussion by her with her aides about how do we find contractors that can put weapons into Libya. It's right there in black and white. And a lot of that email is redacted, so we don't really know the full story. And that's what these lawyers, Jim, were after. They were after that unredacted email and some other things that could prove his case. And guess who blinked? The Justice Department blinked. They didn't want to play anymore, and so they let the guy off.
All right, they've let him off now, and his lawyers were pretty aggressive, I think. And like you said, they played some pretty high-stakes poker, because going up against the Obama administration and the Clintons, you're in the crosshairs legitimately and literally in some cases with those folks. Is there any chance now that he is going to push forward with these allegations, or do you think he's going to take his, the case being dropped as a well-deserved victory and walk away?
I think he's trying to see if there's a book deal out there where he can tell his full story. And so that's a possibility. But by them dropping charges, he's lost his power to subpoena or through discovery to get documents. This could only happen if you have the right judge. If you have a judge that denies all your discovery requests, the Justice Department would have plowed ahead and gotten this guy convicted and sent to prison. It was only because this judge had sided with the defense on his right to view documents that the Justice Department backed down. So whether he now has all the information he needs to go out there publicly and talk, I think at this point it would be his word against the administration at this point.
Is there a possibility that these emails and other things that are floating around from the famous bathroom server of Hillary Clinton might be relevant to helping prove some of these charges?
That's the contention of the defense lawyers, that if some of these emails that have not been released are released, there might be evidence that supports our client. Secondly, there are redacted emails out there now that if the judge could order them to be unredacted and declassified or viewed by people with a security clearance, the information might come out.
But there are also folks without security clearances and probably in possession of these emails who don't have to ask permission to do that. So is that a fear that should be keeping the Clinton campaign up at night?
Or the Benghazi committee, which has a lot of documents they did not release because the Obama administration would not let them release them. If there is a new president, I bet you the new president's White House would give the okay to declassifying a lot of stuff that the Benghazi committee has that they could never put out there. And then we might get the full story about all the arms that were coming into Libya and going out of Libya into Syria, because that flow was going on. We know that. We know the Gulf nations were putting arms into Libya and arms into Syria to help various factions that they thought were on their side. And who ultimately was the sender of those weapons and the financier? Maybe that would come out if the Benghazi committee could really open up its files instead of what they did.
The contention has been that this was an Obama-Clinton operation to supply both the rebels in Syria, and unfortunately, in some cases, those arms went elsewhere, and that's what the operation in Benghazi was about. You know, that they were actually, that was where this was being run out of. And again, all of this leads directly back into the State Department's offices while Hillary was running.
And, you know, I reached out to the Benghazi committee for this story to ask, hey, did the committee find any evidence, perhaps some that you couldn't release, that there was any kind of hanky-panky by Obama in arms in Libya? And I got a silence, no comment. I think there is stuff based on the one email that they did release where she's talking about arms, but it's heavily redacted. I think that's just the tip of other discussions that the Benghazi committee has, which it cannot release because the Obama administration said you can't release it. That report had to be cleared by the Obama administration, and they redacted a lot of stuff. So there's still another story to tell. And don't forget, this is the Justice Department that immediately dropped criminal charges against the Black Panthers when they took office. And on video, we know that they were intimidating voters in Philadelphia. And yet that's one of the first things the Obama Justice Department did. So we know they play politics when it comes to charging people. I mean, we now know that they allowed the Clinton aides to destroy evidence, to destroy their devices, which held the same emails that the State Department is releasing, and some of the 30,000 emails that was destroyed. What other Justice Department would allow people under investigation to destroy their devices? I've never heard of that happening in a criminal investigation.
It shouldn't happen anywhere. And honestly, the only reason you do give immunity to folks is if they're helping you in a prosecution. And since there's no prosecution, this seems nothing but a cover-up. Thank you so much for being one of those shining a light on some pretty dark pieces of our recent history. Up next, we will be talking about the Black Lives Matter movement by a gentleman who has spent considerable time looking at it, Dr. Ron Martinelli. This is Jim Hansen. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hello, I'm Ace Lyons. As a retired 4-star admiral who served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, is a special privilege for me to talk to you about an important new book just released by the Center for Security Policy, China Prepares for Conflict, and Why We Must Do the Same. The book explains that while the Obama administration has dithered over the deterioration of the Middle East and ignored Asia, China has been moving to challenge and displace the dominant role the United States has played in this region and the world since the end of World War II. I am one of 9 co-authors of this important book. The others are former Senator Jim Talent, Gordon Chang, Peter Navarro, Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Frank Gaffney, Fred Flights, and Dean Chang. I explain in my chapter how China's efforts over the last 20 years to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea is an indication of new assertiveness to advance its regional dominance at the expense of the United States. I take issue with President Obama's benign neglect of the threat from China and how Beijing is building islands in the South China Sea that it plans to turn into stationary aircraft carriers to threaten freedom of navigation in this region. Like the other authors of this book, I believe the next president must act immediately to restore American leadership and its military power, both of which have been seriously undermined by the disastrous policies of President Obama. We urgently need to modernize and increase the size of our land, naval, and air forces to stand up to China and other adversaries worldwide. We also need to recognize and counter the growing cyber and intelligence threats from China. The bottom line is that our nation needs to act now. I strongly commend this important book, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. You can read it for free as an ebook on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. This is Jim Hansen, and we're going to talk right now with Dr. Ron Martinelli, who is a nationally renowned forensic criminologist, a retired San Jose, California Police Department detective, and I think most importantly right now, author of the new book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police. Ron, this has been, in my mind, one of the more disgraceful things to happen in recent history. The very idea that somehow our police, who do protect and serve, who do put their lives on the line every day, somehow are a cabal who are
in some way, shape, or form, targeting blacks for assassination is what they would say. Now, I've taught shoot, don't shoot scenarios. I was a member of Army Special Forces, trained hostage rescue units, both U.S. police and some of the foreign units equivalent to Delta. I know exactly how difficult it is to make those life and death decisions. And the idea that A, the police aren't using their best judgment, and B, they're somehow biased against blacks is, in my mind, not just absurd, but insulting. Give us at least your feelings about how the movement has exploited a non-cause into what it is now.
Yeah, sure, Jim. And listen, for your listeners and for full disclosure, as a forensic criminologist and death investigator, my firm and I are involved in about 20% of all these high-profile shootings, police-involved shootings in the United States. And I work all sides. That's what a forensic expert does. So I work for police agencies, but I also work on behalf of major law firms, civil rights law firms that file wrongful death cases. So with me, it's all about the evidence. Having that introduction placed out, to talk specifically about the Black Lives Matter movement, I don't think anybody in the media, and certainly the founders and surrogates of the movement, tell the truth about the movement to the general public. The general public thinks that this is some sort of, social media installed flash mob kind of thing. It's a social justice movement. Let me tell you what they really are. This is a very well nationally and internationally funded Marxist movement. All of the ideology of this movement is Marxist and communist. The founding members, of which there are three women, I don't think anybody knows that, three women are the founding members of the movement, the reaches and tentacles of the secret societies and money laundering operation of George Soros, who is a twice convicted money manipulator from Europe, both in Hungary and in France, fund this movement along with major entertainers like Jay-Z and Beyoncé Carter. So this movement is part of a larger international movement that we have traced to Cuba, Northern Ireland, and the Middle East, referred to as One World, One Struggle. Now, the basic designs of the Black Lives Matter movement I refer to as the 4 Ds with respect to their designs for law enforcement. They want to disenfranchise and diminish the stature of law enforcement with the public. So they want to separate law enforcement from the public, and they've labeled them as basically the bad guys, and they're the good guys. Then what they want to do is they want to defund proactive policing programs, which have been very successful in suppressing violent crime, such as stop and frisk and broken windows. And then eventually, they want to completely dissolve law enforcement and the criminal justice system and create a more Marxist-based policing model and criminal justice model. That's the design.
I wish you weren't telling facts. I wish this was somehow a conspiracy theory or not something we've seen. But our own organization, the Center for Security Policy, reported back when the riots were first happening in Ferguson, Missouri, over a justified shooting there, that the Soros organization and Black Lives Matter were conspiring with some Islamist movements also to put this in a revolutionary perspective. And that's what they are looking at it as. It's a chance to further this revolution. And their goal is obviously to overthrow the current order. And with the police tasked with providing that order, they're the first that have to go. What else are they up to?
Well, let me tell you something. Let's talk about just this one thing that you just brought up, because over the past 40 years, I've dealt a lot with the prison and correction system as a consultant. I don't think the American public knows that one of the fastest moving political slash religious things that's happening in our prison and correction system is the whole you know, infiltration of the prison system by Islamic radicals, using religion, using the Muslim religion as their platform and their vehicle for spreading, you know, things like Black Lives Matter and anti-democratic government rhetoric. So, I mean, that's a really serious thing. And, of course, they're protected by First Amendment, so they can basically go in there and say whatever they want to say, and it's horrible. And by the way, the whole Black Lives Matter movement harkens back to the time of the mid-60s to the early 70s, and this group, all of the leaders and all the heroes of this group come back to the leaders of the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, and the Weather Underground. And now they brought all this rhetoric and this ideology back into a brand new movement.
Now, I think of some of the rhetoric coming from the Black Lives Matter movement and some of the actions that have been taken against police, far too many police officers have died this year, and I would place the blame directly at the hands of these folks for inciting this violence. Is this is there a point where we have to consider this group a domestic terror organization?
Well, I believe if you look at the definitions of what domestic terrorism is, I think that in many of the incidents that have been precipitated by members of the Black Lives Matter movement, it is domestic terrorism. Okay, when you have a Soros funded and Carter funded, meaning Beyonce and Jay-Z Carter funded movement coming into a town like Ferguson and Baltimore and Charlotte, North Carolina, and you have violence against police, you have violence against city government and commercial businesses, you've got you've got the burglaring, you've got the looting, and you've got the arson of buildings and public property. Those acts are domestic terrorist acts. And, you know, I just want to point out something that I just got notification of this morning. And going back to Ferguson, those protesters, many of which were Black Lives Matter protesters that were paid mercenaries from the Soros organization through Black Lives Matter, they filed a $41.5 million lawsuit against law enforcement for violations of civil rights and excessive force. A judge in St. Louis, Missouri, a federal judge, just dismissed that entire lawsuit, U.S. District Judge Henry Autry. And so I think that's very important. And what I read the judge's ruling this morning, and he said basically that the allegations of the plaintiffs in that case were just, he didn't use the word lies, but he said that none of the evidence that they brought forward forensically was proven. As a matter of fact, it was all disproven forensically. It never happened. So these are people going up through the court system, perjuring themselves against law enforcement and filing lawsuits. And that's part of the game with Black Lives Matter to keep law enforcement off balance.
Dr. Ron Martinelli, unfortunately, we're going to have to stop there. Like I said, all of our listeners, please check out his book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police. We cannot let them go.
Let me say the book is available on Amazon. Okay, so Amazon.com, that's how you get that book.
And do get that book. This is Jim Hansen, and that's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank Gaffney will be back tomorrow with more ammunition for you in our war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.